From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson, broadcasting today from KCUR in Kansas City, Missouri.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. On NBC's Today Show this morning, Arizona Senator Jeff Flake said that even though on the Senate floor yesterday he denounced President Trump as a danger to American political norms, Trump is supported by a majority of Arizona voters.
In terms of unfit to hold the office, the voters made their choice. He was elected fair and square.
And in tweets this morning, President Trump said Flake, who announced his resignation yesterday, had, quote, zero chance of being elected. Well, let's hear from Phoenix. Casey Kuhn is there. She's a reporter for KJZZ. Hi there, Casey.
Hi.
So first of all, let me ask you, what was the reaction amongst Arizonans to Senator Flake's speech yesterday?
So it was definitely a surprise, but also not that big of a surprise. I think a lot of polls had shown him behind Kelly Ward, who's a Republican was going to face him for his seat. Just a month ago, he had Marco Rubio come out here to Arizona to help raise fundraise for his campaign. And it wasn't that long ago that he was pretty adamant about being able to beat Kelly Ward. And then also the Democrat who was the leading contender to fight for his seat, Kyrsten Sinema.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So perhaps he was looking at an uphill battle toward reelection. But of course, you know, he had a full year in front of him before election 2018. I'm also seeing that the Hill, for example, the newspaper had called him at one time the original Tea Partier. So what's really changed for Flake?
So Flake is seen as a very traditional conservative. He has very traditional values, but he's also someone who says he might not fit in with the current Republican Party. And that also kind of means he's just part of the Washington institution as a whole. You can add to that his recent book where he did criticize Trump and other conflicts with his party leaders. And that just kind of led to Arizona Republicans looking for an alternative, especially if you're on social media. You'll see a lot of people commenting that this is a great thing for them because they want to see someone who's going to shake up Washington. They want to see someone more like President Donald Trump.
Okay, and so perhaps they see that person in Kelly Ward. I mean, what are her politics? Where does she stand?
So Ward, she's a Republican, obviously, who served in the state Senate. She ran against John McCain in the primary for last year's election. She lost by a pretty decent margin, but she had a high profile. She was an outspoken critic of the Washington establishment. She attacked McCain's age, just someone who definitely had a personality that would fit someone who was looking for someone similar to President Donald Trump. She was just endorsed by former Trump strategist Steve Bannon and has been predicted to win the primary, even when Flake was still running.
Any other Republicans who could throw their hats into the race?
So there's still a lot of speculation. I mean, one analyst I spoke to said we might see someone like sitting Republican congresspeople Martha McSally or David Schweikert. We do know Governor Doug Ducey is not going to run. He tweeted that. There's just bound to be people that are going to throw their name in. It just remains to be seen who thinks they can beat Bannon-backed Kelly Ward.
Right. Okay. So I want to ask you about that because I'm looking at the 2016 Arizona presidential election results, and it looks like Donald Trump carried 49.5% of Arizonan voters, and Hillary Clinton had 45.4%. So, you know, a four-point spread there. But could the Bannon connection to Kelly Ward end up actually galvanizing Arizona Democrats?
I think that's a great question. I think, you know, Kyrsten Sinema, she's seen as a centrist. She's seen as a moderate. And not only could that galvanize, like you said, Arizona Democrats, but could also sway Republicans or independents who maybe feel like Ward is a little too radical. So it does seem possible that Sinema has a shot. And a lot of analysts do say that they think Sinema has a good shot of taking Flake's seat.
Well, it will be an interesting election season in Arizona, no matter what happens. Casey Kuhn, senior field correspondent for KJZZ, speaking to us from Phoenix. Casey, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, in California, the Chief Justice said yesterday that the state's current bail system should be scrapped, that it's unsafe and unfair. One of the problems with California's current system is that some bail agents resort to illegal means to get business. Bail agents help the accused get the money they need for bail. 2 years ago, authorities in Santa Clara County arrested 31 bail bonds agents for recruiting new clients inside the county's jails with the help of inmates. KQED's Suki Lewis reports.
Early on an August morning in 2015, officers surrounded Dino Garcia's house.
Seven police officers in undercover cars parked in front of my house with a loudspeaker, guns pointed at me at 7 a.m. Mind you, I had my three-week-old grandson in my arm. So when I went to open the blind, a laser hit him. The laser was going slowly up to me, and I says, holy smokes, I thought I was dreaming.
Garcia was used to getting people out of Santa Clara County Jail. Now he was headed there himself.
I did bail out. When I tried calling other bail bondsmen, friends of mine, it was funny because I couldn't get through to anyone. Everybody was in jail.
Along with Garcia, law enforcement picked up 30 other agents. It was the single largest bust of its kind in California history. To explain why they were arrested, let's go to Santa Clara's main jail, where you often see guys standing around outside.
I just want to know, like, how long do you stand out here?
I don't know. I stand out here from 7:30 to 4.
He's handing out flyers for a bail bonds firm. The more than 65,000 people booked into custody here annually represent a gold mine, around $25 million in potential revenue for bail companies. This guy is advertising to get a piece of that business, legally. Dino Garcia was arrested for getting business in a different way.
A typical scenario would go like this.
Santa Clara District Attorney Jeff Rosen.
An inmate would call a bail company and say, hey, this new guy just got brought into the jail, and I think he needs bail. Do you guys want to try to sell a bail bond to him?
The DA's investigation found that longtime inmates would use promises of cheap bail, or sometimes threats of violence, to funnel incoming inmates to particular bail companies. In exchange, bail agents would pay these recruiters or give them free phone calls. Getting business this way is illegal because it gives those bail companies an unfair advantage and leaves inmates open to exploitation.
When someone is locked up in custody, they're in a very vulnerable position. They don't have a lot of information, and that's why the law says that the only person that can initiate contact with a bail company is either the inmate himself, a member of the inmate's immediate family, or their attorney.
New inmates don't realize they might be released without having to pay any bail, or even how to call a bail agent. That's where Scott Culp came in.
You have a prepaid call from Scott, an inmate at the Pleasant Valley State Prison, Coalinga, California.
Culp is currently an inmate at Pleasant Valley State Prison in Coalinga, California, serving time for armed robbery. But he spent about 3 years in the Santa Clara main jail, where he says he was one of the bail agency's main recruiters.
How did you get the inmates to go along with it?
Well, they have no choice.
Culp says in the unit where he was serving time, new inmates weren't given instructions on how to use the phone codes needed to make a call, so he'd help them.
I take their code, I use their code, so they're not able to call their family to have their family bail them out. They have to go through me vis-a-vis these bail bond agencies.
Culp says each bail agency had a specialty. Some catered to particular ethnicities or were known for handling DUIs or domestic violence cases. He claims one agency took anything for collateral.
Computers, cars, dope, whatever you wanted.
Culp says bail agents paid him $15,000 over the course of a year, which is pretty good money if you're locked up. Dino Garcia, the former bail agent, says he never gave inmates money, but court records suggest at the very least he was setting his recruiters up with free phone calls. Over the course of 5 months, inmates made almost 1,000 calls to Garcia's phone. He says he took their calls because,
you know, we're trying to get business. We're trying to help people out.
It was really a gentleman's type of business, in spite of the stigma bail bonds has.
Ted Wallace says that was 30 years ago when he started selling bail bonds. Since then, the industry has changed. County judges raised bail amounts, and Wallace says new agents started pouring in, attracted by the opportunity to make big money.
I wouldn't associate with the bunch that are in here now. They're in here for the money. They don't treat their customers properly.
Wallace says one of his clients was threatened by an inmate recruiting for a bail company.
He said, well, you got some kids, don't you? The guy said, yeah, I got kids. He says, you know, sometimes when kids are going to school in the morning, accidents happen. And I went, oh.
Not all bail agents resort to threats or bribes to get business. And many, like Ted Wallace, want to rid their industry of the seedy characters who give it a bad name. Here's Jeff Clayton, director of the American Bail Coalition.
We don't agree with people doing the alleged conduct, and if it is happening, it does need to be stopped.
In fact, it was complaints by other bail agents that first prompted the DA's investigation. Unlawful bail practices aren't unique to Santa Clara County, though, and the problem seems to be growing. The California Department of Insurance, which regulates the bail industry, estimates that since 2012, complaints about illegal activity by bail agents have tripled in the state. In April, Dino Garcia begins serving a 3-month sentence.
I just wanted to get back to my life, and now I don't have to worry about much anymore.
Most of the 31 bail agents have taken plea deals, ranging from community service to 4 months in jail. For Here and Now, I'm Suki Lewis.
And we're broadcasting today from KCUR in Kansas City, a city on the border of two states, including Kansas, which is dealing with the aftermath of a bold economic experiment, massive tax cuts. It started in 2010 when the state's governor, Republican Sam Brownback, was elected. 2010 was a year when many states were struggling to rebound after the Great Recession.
Kansas, for years, had been thought of as being somewhat behind other states in the region in terms of their growth.
That's Kenneth Kriz, a professor of public finance at Wichita State University.
There was a push, starting really with the first years of the Brownback administration, to try to do something within tax policy to help turn the tide and to make Kansas more attractive as a place to live and do business.
And what were the promises?
The promises were that the tax cut package, when passed, would create a shot of adrenaline, I think was the term that was used.
Like a shot of adrenaline straight into the heart. It'll jolt our state and give us a dynamic growth. We need that.
That's Governor Brownback, who said his plan would boost growth by attracting more people and business to Kansas and would add an additional 22,000 jobs over 5 years. The plan reduced the number of tax brackets for individual income from 3 to 2 and cut taxes on both. And there was one more thing.
One of the fundamental pieces of it was the exemption of pass-through income, so income that was reported on the individual tax return, but was passed through from non-corporate entities.
Think small businesses like sole proprietorships, partnerships, and S corporations. Business revenue can be taxed as individual income. When the plan was implemented in Kansas, Brownback had dropped the pass-through tax to zero.
We took to zero the income tax on all LLCs, sub-S's, and sole proprietorships. So any income under LLCs, sub-S, sole proprietorship, zero income tax. And the reason for that... The reason for that is that's your job-creating machine.
The problem, says Kenneth Kriz, is that the 0% tax was too easy for companies to exploit.
There are a lot of really big companies that are actually LLCs, like big law firms, in this state, oil exploration companies.
And they were able to take advantage of a 0% tax rate under this proposal.
Exactly. And a lot of them did that. And what it also created, I think it's fair to say, is a lot of relabeling. So most famously, a couple of the basketball coaches were alleged to have titled themselves as independent contractors in order to be able to take advantage of it for their multi-million dollar incomes.
And were the proponents saying that the plan would pay for itself?
Yes. In fact, it was. They were predicting there would be so much revenue that the state wouldn't know what to do with it.
The theory of the plan, supply side or trickle-down economics, has long held the favor of Republicans, and it comes directly from the playbook of Arthur Laffer.
Any serious model tells you that economic growth always leads to increases in revenues, not reductions in revenue.
Laffer is considered by many to be the father of supply-side economics. He advised President Reagan and played a part in designing the economic platform for the Trump presidential campaign. He also helped create the Kansas tax plan, and he believes in it.
You know, you can look at all of these comparisons, and you really find that there's a strong pattern. Is, you know, those states that cut their tax rates or have no income tax do better.
So, Is this going to be a story about Kansas finally taking its place as America's richest state, having attracted multiple Fortune 500 companies with their low tax rates? Sadly, no, says economist Kenneth Criz. So how long did it take for people to figure out that it wasn't working?
1 year. From fiscal year 2013, which was half done by the time the cuts came into place, to fiscal year 2014, which was the first year that they were in effect, revenues dropped on the order of $600 to $700 million from the individual income tax. And to put it in context, the state general fund budget is about $6 billion. And so that's 10% revenue loss in 1 year. That's a lot for any government to have to make up.
To make it up in Kansas, state lawmakers tried to balance the budget by using the state's reserves and by tapping into its highway fund. Construction projects were put on hold, pension contributions went down, and essential services like Medicaid were cut. The state also changed the school funding formula, making big cuts and closing and consolidating several school districts, which remains a particularly controversial topic in a state where school funding consumes about half the budget.
No, there's never been any jumping off a cliff quite like this.
Burdette Loomis is a political scientist at the University of Kansas in Lawrence. He says the Kansas experiment was a sea change for state politics.
From the early 70s through, honestly, through 2010, you had a combination of Republican and Democratic governors, generally Republican legislatures, but by and large, I think it was a moderate conservative government that pretty much reflected the nature of Kansans.
So what happened?
2010 happened. A national wave in the wake of Obama and Obamacare. So this occurred across the country. 700 state legislators moved from Democratic to Republican. Brownback came in. I think he probably would have won anyway, but he came in on this wave without any question he was going to win, and did. Brought in a very conservative Kansas House. The Senate wasn't up that year. Passed a revolutionary income tax bill that was supposed to send Kansas into high levels of prosperity. My personal thought here is that Brownback came back to Kansas from the Senate to demonstrate that Kansas could be this small government heaven on earth that would help him, honestly, run for president in 2012.
He didn't end up running. By 2014, the deficit issues were well known and Kansas's bond rating had been downgraded. Moderate Republicans in the legislature were actively campaigning for the Democratic candidate. Brownback barely won re-election. But his fight was far from over. His own party fought against him and overturned his tax cuts with enough votes to override the governor's veto. Again, political scientist Burdette Loomis.
By 2015, 2016, it was very clear that most Kansans did not agree with the tax cuts at all, largely because they saw declines in services or potential declines in services.
And the amazing thing is that it was the Republicans in the legislature who had to override his veto with the help of Democrats, it wouldn't have happened without Republicans.
Historically, you've had this moderate Republican slash Democratic majority. Push comes to shove. They were the majority that did things. This year, not only did you have to have a majority, you had to override Governor Brownback's veto. So you had moderate Republicans who made a resurgence in 2016. You had Democrats who did well in 2016. But the last few votes in both the Senate and the House were really quite conservative Republicans who just sucked it up and said, we really need to have revenues or this state is going to be in huge difficulties.
At the pizza shop in Johnson County, where a group of Republicans were meeting, we found Marianne Waldenmeyer, who admits the tax cuts didn't work as advertised, but she blames other factors.
I think Brownback has been a very good governor, and he's a very good man, and the experiment would not work in the state of Kansas for three reasons. The wheat crop really was an issue. The less pumping of the oil was an issue. And also the aircraft industry in the Wichita area caused a lot of the tax not to be realized. And basically, Kansas is probably not a large enough state to have that experiment work.
At a park in Lawrence, we found Kurt Hall, who's the local chair of the Democratic Party. He says the tax cuts were such a disaster, his membership went up.
Heavens, yes.
Really?
A lot of them, yeah. Huh. Yeah, that's been our problem, is how to keep them fired up and how to keep give them something to do that they feel like that, you know, they're making some headway.
Governor Brownback still has not admitted defeat, although he's leaving office soon to take a position in the Trump administration. The state is dealing with a court ruling that could require the next governor to raise taxes again because schools are deemed underfunded. And now Washington is considering a plan that looks very similar to what happened in Kansas. I asked economist Kenneth Criz about that.
My advice to Washington would be simple, is that don't be fooled that tax cuts are going to pay for themselves. Again, regardless of the structure, studies, careful academic studies have shown that tax cuts tend to pay from anywhere between 10% and 30% of their costs. So if we cut taxes by $1 trillion, we're going to probably get an extra $100 billion to $300 back in extra revenues from economic growth. But that still leaves $700 to $900 billion in cuts that'll have to be made. Those cuts also have an economic effect in drawing down the economy. So what I always tell people here is, don't kid yourself. A school teacher's salary is it might be lower than a private sector worker's salary, but it's all money that goes into the economy. So if you have to cut school teachers, if you have to cut highway workers, if you have to cut anything based upon cuts in spending, that's money out of the economy, just like the tax money was in the first place.
Melissa Rooker was one of the Republican legislators who led the charge to roll back the tax cuts. She says those hoping to cut taxes in Washington should pay attention to what happened in Kansas.
We had counties in the state with not a single highway patrol officer on the beat. Riots in our prisons. The foster care system in our state it's an unbelievable disaster right now.
We'll hear more tomorrow from Melissa Rooker and today from the man who will inherit Kansas's budget mess when he becomes governor.
JetBlue is reducing winter service to Puerto Rico as tourism suffers in the wake of Hurricane Maria. The company said that during an earnings call yesterday. But the airline is still offering price-capped fares with free checked bags for people traveling between Puerto Rico and the mainland U.S. through November 15th. And they're not the only ones helping out. Joining us now with more, Seth Kaplan. He's managing partner at the publication Airline Weekly. And Seth, first of all, I mean, we remember airlines being accused of price gouging during Hurricanes Harvey and Irma, less so during Maria. So what's changed?
Well, you're right. You know, back then, at first, the airline said, look, this is not gouging. This is just what always happens, rather, when a whole lot of people, want those very scarce airline seats, just kind of pushes up the prices. Consumers and some politicians weren't buying it. And so they knew that they had to get it right this time. First of all, they had fare caps where they said, look, no matter how many people want to fly, we're not going to charge more than a certain amount of money, depending on the airline. And even more importantly, after the storm passed, they really shifted into this mode that they've been in of doing what they could to help Puerto Rico.
Okay, so what are some of those things? I mean, we did mention that JetBlue is adding more flights and flying in relief supplies even. So what are other airlines doing?
Yeah, JetBlue is the busiest airline of all in Puerto Rico, so no surprise that they've really ramped up their efforts. But other airlines too, United, I think this is one interesting example of how much you can do with one airplane, told me about a 777. So it's one of their big planes that normally might be flying to Europe or Asia, but instead, flew down to San Juan with 300 volunteers, doctors, nurses, engineers, and 50,000 pounds of relief supplies, and then came back with 200 evacuees. Other airlines doing that too. American got a woman who was 38 weeks pregnant out in order to deliver her baby in Miami. The flight was so full, they couldn't even get her husband on that first flight, but they got him on a later one, and he was actually there by the time the baby was born. And it's not just people. Southwest Airlines flew in 250 pounds of dog food for the TSA canines, also supplies and food for animals in local shelters there in San Juan.
Okay, interesting. Do we know how much this is costing the airlines?
You know, my math says probably in the tens of millions of dollars between the cash contributions which they made too, and then just flying these humanitarian flights, in some cases not making any money off those flights, in other cases donating some cargo capacity, you know, taking supplies aboard a flight where they all are also selling airline tickets. And that's in addition to the hundreds of millions of dollars that all the airlines together will have lost just because of the hurricane itself, from lost business and then the other costs associated with dealing with what happened.
What about all the employees who work for these airlines on the island? I mean, I imagine that their lives were as upended as anyone else's. They're in Puerto Rico. Are the airlines doing things to help their staff out?
Yeah, JetBlue tells me they have 350 employees based in Puerto Rico, not even counting some people who commute into and out of the island. So obviously those people have their own personal issues. You know, they're without power. In some cases, they've lost their homes. And so they've set up down there what they've called kind of a makeshift Costco, a warehouse full of supplies that those employees can take for their own needs. And they've also flown in volunteers from the mainland to relieve those employees to work at the airports, for example, so that those employees can look after their own families.
Yeah. Well, Seth Kaplan, managing partner at Airline Weekly. Seth, thanks so much.
Thank you, Meghna.
And I'm broadcasting today from KCUR in Kansas City, where we've been spending the past few days looking at some of the big stories that are playing out here on the border of Kansas and Missouri. And joining us now are two journalists who've been following the news here for years. Kyle Palmer of KCUR. Hi, Kyle.
Hi, good morning.
And Mary Sanchez of the Kansas City Star. Mary, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And the big story today on your newspaper's website is that Missouri Governor Eric Greitens gave a recent speech to Republicans in Iowa. There is speculation that this first-term governor is using his job as a launching pad for a White House bid. I can't believe we're already talking about the next White House bids, but there we are. Should the rest of the country get ready to learn more about Eric Greitens?
I would say yes and no. No, because he has a job here that he needs to be doing, and he needs to be attending to the business of the state of Missouri. It is true, however, that he is probably seeing this as a launching pad to national office. It is the wrong thing for him to do, I would say, as a columnist and member of the Kansas Star editorial board. Again, he needs to prove himself here. Eric Greitens did not have a political history before he became our governor.
But he's already done some things since he's gotten in office, including right to work in Missouri, right?
He has done some things. And actually, I would give him some credit that one of the things that he's looking at is the previous governor, Jay Nixon, did not fill a lot of board positions. And one of them that's incredibly important to Kansas City is the positions of the police board. The governance of our police board is not locally governed. Hmm. The governor gets to do those appointments, and the past governor had let some of those go lapse. And now we're in a position where this new governor was able to basically stack the board. Hmm. It's a huge issue.
Now, on the other side of the border, in Kansas, we've been here talking about the tax cuts that Governor Brownback put into effect that put a huge hole in the Kansas budget over the past few years. Right now, as you know, Washington is debating a plan that looks a lot like the one in Kansas. Kyle, how are people here feeling about the idea of tax cuts at the federal level, given what happened?
Well, I think if you look back at the 2016 election results nationally compared to Kansas, while much of the nation, you could argue, went more right, went mm-hmm. more red, Kansas, which has been a red state for a long time, went a little bit more purple, went a little bit more to the left into the spectrum. They had a sweeping change in the state legislature. A lot of new lawmakers were voted in, and a lot of previously conservative Brownback allies were voted out. And a big part of that was because of the tax cuts. And I think a lot of Kansans' dissatisfaction with the tax cuts, which were passed in 2012, the governor, Brownback, touted it at the time as, you know, kind of the great conservative social experiment that was finally being allowed to play out at a state level. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, the budget deficit. Now, Brownback and his allies will argue that's because of a lot of other variety of factors. Natural resource production in the state has gone down. Other businesses have gone down. The oil industry has suffered through a hard time. But I think the way the voters voted in 2016 is a sign that Kansas and Kansans might be tired of the tax cuts.
Well, and one of the consequences of the tax cuts was that there has been a cut in the prison system budget in Kansas, and you've been reporting on riots that have taken place in the prisons.
Well, the DOC, the problems within the DOC and the issues that they're facing, I think, are becoming more and more paramount as the weeks go by. Yes, there have been a number of riots at prisons across the state. The prisons are overcrowded. The DOC has affected a policy of once a riot happens, taking busloads of prisoners and driving them to another prison. Mm. And that is their way to kind of solve the problem or at least counteract the problem, get prisoners in a different space, get them out of the prison where they might have started problems or been dissatisfied before. And that in turn, I think a lot of criminologists say, is actually contributing to the problem because you're having, you're having uncertainty among the prison population, right, and they're getting they don't have a good handle of the rules of the prison that they're getting sent into. So it is a very big mess.
Mary, how is the opioid crisis playing out here on both sides of the border?
You know, exactly the same way as it is nationally. It's a huge. I mean, it is an epidemic. It's something that is cutting into demographics that people, quite honestly, don't always think about as having problems with drugs. You think of it as a street illegal drug thing, but the prescription drug, it's a crisis, and it has impacted so many families at so many levels, just as people struggle to get off these drugs. And the problem is, I think we're only at the very, very beginning of understanding how we got here. And it has so much to do with pharmaceutical industries. It has a lot to do with the benefit management firms that set up pricing. It has to do with doctors. It has to do with attitudes about pain in U.S. society and our willingness to take drugs.
Is it going to be an issue that people here vote on, do you think, in the next election, that it's important enough that it will be something that they vote on?
I think only if you saw a politician take just a crazy stand on it. And thankfully, most of them, you mentioned Greitens. Greitens had a family member who died of an overdose. So he has spoken on that issue. However, Missouri was the last one to get the
prescription drug monitoring, yes, database. I mean, yeah, 49 other states had a similar program where you're able to kind of check up on – it's supposed to tamp down on so-called doctor shopping where you check up on who gives prescriptions and how many doctors the patients are going around to. And Missouri was the last state to do that. Barely did so.
The way they enacted it, it basically kind of goes after the doctors more than it allows the doctors to help a patient and steer them towards some sort of aid.
How are people here feeling about President Trump right now?
Depends on who you ask. I mean, we right, definitely have, Kansas City is like a lot of areas. You'll have a lot of rural input, and there becomes this divide between an urban and a rural tone and voice. I think a lot of people in communities, do feel left behind. And so some of the messages that he said while campaigning fit for what some people felt for their own economic needs. However, at this point, just the egregious things that fly out of his mouth and out of his fingers into Twitter, to the inappropriateness of attacking people like John McCain, that has just rubbed people the wrong way. I mean, it's just, the Midwest is a fairly polite society.
Right.
And it's just wrong.
Yeah, I think an interesting proxy might be next year when you see Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill challenged by a man who, by all intents and purposes, seems to be a fairly popular young up-and-coming Republican politician, the state attorney general in Missouri, Josh Hawley. He just announced his campaign after kind of being pressured to enter the race. It's interesting the dance that Hawley's already doing, trying to, I think, catch the Trump wave while at the same time not be identified too closely with some of the things that Mary said that President Trump is saying. And a lot of people see Senator McCaskill as extremely vulnerable next year.
I just want to ask each of you one more thing, and we just have about a minute left here, but what's the one story in Kansas City that people outside Kansas and Missouri are not paying enough attention to? Start with you, Mary.
Well, we already touched on it a little bit, and it just gets into criminal justice reforms. I mean, I just think it's one of these issues that we have trouble writing on. People don't want to pay attention, but the problems that are going on within our criminal justice system, the pipelines of throwing people in, not really helping them, recidivism, it just cannot continue. Mental health crisis within these prison populations is a large part of what's going on.
Yeah, and I would echo that in a different vein. I think, KCUR, I'll give a shout out to our own reporter, Dan Margulies, who's done a lot of great reporting about the overburdened public defender system in the state of Missouri. At least here in the Kansas City office, on average, public defenders have 80 to 100 cases per week. Statewide, that average is up around 200 cases per public defender, and they're not able to serve the clients, and they've actually started to resist and say, we're not taking any more clients, which the Missouri Supreme Court says is actually unconstitutional. You have to take anyone who walks through your door, and the public defenders are starting to fight back and say, we can't serve the people that we're supposed to serve with all the cases that we have.
We got through all of those topics, and we never even talked about barbecue. But don't worry, we're going to do that tomorrow. KCUR's Kyle Palmer and the Kansas City Star's Mary Sanchez. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we saw the sad news today that we lost the great Fats Domino, who died in New Orleans at the age of 89. We're going to be hearing a lot of his songs over the next few days as we remember him. But since we are here in Kansas City, we wanted to close out this segment with this one.
I'm going to Kansas City. Kansas City, here I come. I'm going to Kansas City. Kansas City, here I come. They got some pretty little women there, and I'm gonna get me one.
Let's take a moment to talk a bit more about White House Chief of Staff John Kelly's rather remarkable press conference last week. Kelly was responding to criticism of President Trump's condolence call to the widow of a soldier killed in Niger. The retired Marine Corps general also spoke emotionally about his own experience after his son was killed in Afghanistan. But to some, they questioned Kelly's tone and meaning when he talked about the relationship between soldiers and civilians.
We don't look down upon those of you that haven't served. In fact, in a way, we're a little bit sorry, because you'll never have experienced the wonderful joy you get in your heart when you do the kind of things our servicemen and women do.
Well, Robert Killebrew is a retired Army Infantry and Special Forces officer. He wrote about General Kelly's comments for Foreign Policy, and he joins us. Colonel Killebrew, welcome to Here and Now.
Well, thanks for having me.
You know, I was eager to speak with you because a lot of people have reacted to General Kelly's press conference in a very particular way, sort of wondering about what his comments tell us about his attitude of soldiers versus civilians. But in your Foreign Policy piece, you said you heard something entirely different in Kelly's tone and what he said. What did you hear?
I was struck by kind of almost a self-pitying tone. The idea that soldiers in combat or soldiers who follow the military profession, and I mean soldiers, but anybody who wears a uniform, is somehow sort of special because we've sacrificed and we put ourselves somehow above civilians on a different plane, bothered me enormously. That's why I wrote the piece.
And why did it bother you?
It bothered me because we all elect to be soldiers. We have a volunteer force now. We enter a pretty closed-off profession that requires us to surrender a little bit of our personal freedom and get back a profession that's enormously satisfying physically and emotionally and intellectually. We don't need to be lionized by the public. We're proud of what we do, and we're proud to serve this country. We're not telling anybody they should be like us. The tone of General Kelly's remarks made me think that he thinks military service and military veterans are somehow on a plane above civilians. That's very troublesome. We are privileged to serve, not the other way around.
But let me ask you, though, perhaps not a plane above, but a group apart, though, because, you know, members of the military do willingly choose a profession in which, unlike many other professions, the possibility of losing your life is front and center. And I would say that since a relatively small fraction of Americans choose to serve in the military, that does sort of make it a special group of people.
It makes them separate, but not special in the way that I heard General Kelly talking about. The thing about the military service is it is a separate profession with its own rules and its own outlooks. And the longer you stay in the service, the more you become the service, if that makes sense. You can serve a 4-year hitch, get out, go to college, and go on and be look back on your service and be proud. But if you stay in for 20 or 30 years, you start to see the world almost entirely in military terms. You're not conscious of it, but you think the way you've been trained to think.
Mm-hmm.
And when I heard General Kelly talking, I said, there is a guy in a high political position with a distinguished military career who is still thinking like a general and still has the attitude of separateness from his fellow civilians. For whatever it's worth, that attitude was evident in Douglas MacArthur, who was fired by Harry Truman for insubordination. It scares me a little bit to think that a person with the attitudes that General Kelly displayed in that briefing sits at the elbow of an erratic president.
Hmm. Well, so to that point, I mean, General Kelly is in a unique position here. And in your piece in Foreign Policy, you talked about how distinguished military career can make someone a good bureaucrat and maybe a great chief of staff. But then you also write, but not someone who has a gut-level understanding of democracy. Is that your concern about General Kelly?
We didn't spend a lot of time in democracies in the service. What we get in the service is a highly structured way of thinking about problems and reacting to threats. We don't have a lot of patience with the processes of democracy. We, for example, tend not to understand the true functions of a free press. That's why, as a rule, soldiers will be a good processor of things. We can make the trains run on time. We can make a good chief of staff. We don't make good politicians.
Hmm. Well, Robert Killebrew is a retired Army Infantry and Special Forces officer. He spent 30 years in the United States military. Colonel Killebrew, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was my privilege. Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson in Kansas City. We'll be here again tomorrow. You can find all our stories at hereandnow.org. This is Here and Now.